Chapter 75. Saving the World. It was 1992, and I'd been living in Toowoomba for 5 years, but I was restless and longing for adventure. So, I accepted an overseas service bureau posting as a sewing instructor at the Manzini Industrial Training Center in Swaziland. I was brimful of creative ideas, and the idealistic verve necessary to implement my self-appointed task, to save the Swazis, one stitch at a time. Breaking camp took a bit of doing. I found a tenant for my house. I'd hoped for a 2-year lease, but she was only prepared to sign up for 6 months, with the option of a further 6. This wasn't ideal, but, as it turned out, it was just perfect. I flew into Melbourne with 2 huge suitcases containing what I thought I'd need to get started in Swaziland, as well as my tiny sewing machine, as I couldn't contemplate living anywhere without it. Before we left, the Overseas Service Bureau provided a 3-day intensive pre-departure training for the next group of volunteers off to Africa. It was a high-energy affair, fueled by our collective excitement, fear, and apprehension about where we were headed, and what we'd find when we got there. We flew out of Melbourne, with a 2-hour layover in Perth and then on to Harare and finally Manzini. It was a painful trip, as I'd strained my back lifting my super-heavy suitcases in and out of vehicles getting to the airport. Because of this, whilst in Perth awaiting the Harare flight, I spent most of the time lying flat on the floor of the terminal, in an attempt to relieve the pain. This wasn't a promising start. After overnighting in Harare, I took a smaller aircraft into Manzini, the second largest town in Swaziland. I was met there by Sister Judith, a visionary Anglican nun, who'd set up the training center, with the blessing of her friend, the King of Swaziland. The facility was similar to an Australian technical and further education college, where young Swazis received training in a variety of trades. I was straightaway taken from the airport to meet an Australian couple, Ali and Jack, who'd been with the centre for almost a year. At the outset, there was no accommodation available for me in the staff compound, so the Australians were asked to put me up until a unit became available. I was very lucky to have these people provide an introduction to the rhythms of what was to become my working life in Swaziland. Ali was a foodie of some repute from South Australia, who'd come to Swaziland to set up a pilot pickle project making achar, a spicy condiment eaten throughout southern Africa. They'd invested in a 4-wheel drive vehicle for their own use, and for her project, as she needed fresh ingredients for achar, and the Manzini market sold plenty. Jack had a management background, and ran the printery. He'd designed and printed classy labels and caps for Ali's pickle jars. His design was a lift from the Harrods Food Hall, in London. The result was an upmarket presentation of a quality product, targeting the moneyed visitors of Kruger National Park, north of Swaziland. On my first day at the centre, I looked in on Ali's project, and afterwards wandered the campus to visit each workshop. The campus was a hive of activity, offering training for men in plumbing, carpentry, panel beating, building, agriculture, printing, and mechanics, with sewing for women. At the sewing workshop, I met my Swazi counterpart, and the trainees. I familiarized myself with the facility and the equipment, at the same time watching the trainees at work. As I walked around the space, I noticed 2 racks of garments pushed against the back wall. On closer inspection, the quality of construction was of concern, and I could immediately see sewing straight was a challenge. I was told that once a month the garment racks were lifted onto the back of the center's truck and taken to the Manzini markets, where a group of trainees spent the day selling the garments. This monthly exercise was part of the curriculum, giving the trainees important retailing experience. I hadn't been at the center long before I was asked to interview the next batch of hopefuls wanting to learn to sew. Strangely, all the interviewees gave the same answer to my question, "Why do you want to learn to sew?" Their answer, I want to help my country and learn to make children's clothes to sell at the market. My first challenge was to teach the trainees how to sew straight. Because both fabric and thread were in short supply, some urgent lateral thinking was required. With Jack's blessing, I scrounged a quantity of light card offcuts from the printery and took them back to the sewing workshop. Using an unthreaded machine, I showed the trainees how to use the left or right side of the machine's foot to follow the edge of the cardboard. I explained that the trick was to watch the edge of the foot, not the needle. Each student's success or failure was gauged by the rows of needle perforations, straight or otherwise. When each trainee had mastered straight lines, I upped the ante and introduced curved ones. Success. After a week or so, I realized that in addition to teaching sewing to 30 women with zero sewing experience, I was also expected to attract sewing jobs to cover the cost of running the workshop. This involved costing and quoting, then supervising hardly capable stitchers to fill the orders. This assumption was an unexpected bombshell. At no time during the placement briefings do I recall being told that I'd be required to make the workshop pay for itself. I understood I was recruited to teach sewing. After I'd recovered from the shock and taken time to reassess the situation, I decided that as I'd come all this way, I should give it my best shot. The Reader's Digest Complete Guide to Sewing I'd brought with me was an absolute godsend, as it covered every sewing skill in the center's curriculum. These included smocking and lampshade making, which struck me as surprising inclusions, but I kept my views to myself. On my arrival in Swaziland, I discovered that the country was in the second year of drought. I was well acquainted with drought, particularly the crunch of parched grass underfoot and the smell of withering dryness. But the smell of drought took on a completely different guise at the center. As Swazi men piss anywhere, the smell of stale urine was ever present, and, not surprisingly, the sewing building filled with women was a favorite target. Occasionally I found myself gagging involuntarily as the slightest breeze could bring with it an unexpected whiff of stale piss. I hated it, but there was no escape. All I could do was pray for rain. Away from work, I discovered making friends was tricky. Yes, there were other English-speaking volunteers living with me in the staff compound. They were mostly men, a wild bunch of skilled misfits, bouncing from one volunteer placement to another, hooked on the excitement of life in the developing world. Finding folk with similar interests outside the compound was also difficult, because I didn't have my own transport. In the wider community, I noticed volunteers were viewed with suspicion by everyone. I discovered that the Swazis were wary of Europeans. This was understandable as their forebears had been colonized by the British for decades, whilst entrepreneurial Europeans saw volunteers like me as pesky do-gooders. As a result, I found myself wedged between a rock and a hard place. Fortunately, I had one contact in South Africa. A South African Australian, whom I'd met in 1983, when we both moved to Toowoomba to lecture at the Darling Downs Institute. As newbies, we bonded because we shared an interest in art and textiles, and our friendship continued on my return from Scotland in 1987. She was in South Africa to complete the research for her doctorate, through the University of Pretoria, and I telephoned her occasionally. Sometime later she threw me a lifeline, but I digress. My strained back continued to be troublesome, affecting my ability to walk long distances. This was a distinct disadvantage in a strange country without a vehicle. I found a massage therapist in Manzini and a chiropractor in Imbabane, 40 kilometers up the road, but getting to either was difficult. Ali kindly drove me to and from appointments a number of times, but there was little improvement in my condition for our efforts. In an attempt to enter wholeheartedly into Swazi life and to take my mind off the pain, I found a Siswati language tutor. As I'd already mastered a couple of other languages in addition to English, I assumed another one wouldn't be too difficult. How wrong I was. Saswati is a Bantu language made up of prefixes and suffixes, creating incredibly long words, and it wasn't long before I had to admit defeat. This was the first of a series of defeats. But I soldiered on, doing the best I could under the circumstances. On reflection. Saving the Swazis. I was on a misguided mission to save the world and I planned to begin with the Swazis. Not long after I began working with the sewing trainees, I realized the Swazis didn't need saving, but I did. I was the one with the problem. My world began to crumble, and I was forced to ask myself what was I doing in Swaziland. Sewing instructor or workshop manager. I came to realize that in Africa, it's assumed that all Europeans possess business acumen and labor management skills. Unfortunately, I didn't possess either skill and, as a result, I found myself floundering. Before too long it became clear that I was on a road to nowhere. Stale urine. As I have heightened olfactory sensitivity, I was extremely distressed by the smell of stale urine I'd unexpectedly catch both inside and outside the sewing workshop, and when walking the Manzini streets as well. There was no escape. That disgusting smell is my abiding memory of my time in Swaziland. Facts. Swaziland is a small landlocked country in southern Africa. It's 200 kilometers long by 130 kilometers wide. In 1992, the population was almost 900,000. By 2025, the population had risen to 1.25 million. For 62 years between 1906 and 1968, Swaziland was a British protectorate. In 2018, 26 years after my short stay, and 50 years after independence from Britain, the king changed the name of his country to Eswatini. The Reader's Digest Complete Guide to Sewing. This publication was my Bible for the time I was teaching sewing in Swaziland. I photocopied many pages from it for the trainees.